On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Oliver Riss back on the show while the rest of the co-hosts are gallivanting in Alaska. Today, we're going to talk about dark data, right? That's right. That's the not so valuable data that your organization is unintentionally collecting and storing, but cyber criminals, they love it. Plus, our guest today, Ranga Badla, he's Vice President of Field Engagement and Marketing at Oracle. We're going to discuss simplifying tech stacks to reduce costs plus ERP. Is that the answer for your organization? Definitely shouldn't miss it. Twyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 550, recorded June 30th, 2023. Shine a light on dark data. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Collide. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures that if a device isn't secure, it can't access your apps. It's zero trust for Okta. Visit collide.com/TWiT and book a demo today. And by Lookout. Whether on a device or in the cloud, your business data is always on the move. Minimize risk, increase visibility, and ensure compliance with Lookout's unified platform. Visit lookout.com today. And by ZipRecruiter. If you're hiring, you're currently dealing with a slowing economy, which adds to your challenges. Thankfully, there's a hiring partner who's focused on you and your needs. ZipRecruiter. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/TWiT. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how those worlds connect. And I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through the big world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professional and the expert. So I'm going to bring in Mr. Oliver Riss. He's a longtime friend in the show. Oliver, it's been a while, my friend. How you been?
I've been good. I've been all right. It's getting hot here in Connecticut. We're going to hit over 100 in the next couple of weeks. Won't that be awesome? But I made sure my air conditioner works, so I probably won't die.
Now, you're not getting hit with any smoke, right?
No, like I said, yeah, we saw it bad about a week and a half ago. Like, it was really gray. Like, it was kind of frightening, but it's been clear as a bell since then. So I don't know what I'm getting in my lungs, teehee, but
it looks fine. Out of sight, out of mind. That's the way it is. Well, I will tell you one thing. I did read a recent article on Worth by You, Hottest Electric Motorcycles Out There. And I know, I can tell you, I'm a motorcycle enthusiast. My wife won't let me get them because we have small
children. Dude!
But I want to ask you a question. The Livewire S2 Del Mar or the Curtis 1? Which one?
Curtis 1. Without, he actually... I'm going to get to ride it. I got to fly to California to do it, but he's going to let me actually sit on it and actually move it around, which I thought was, I'm terrified because if I drop it, I'm screwed. But look, if you want to buy a bike, you can store it in my garage. It's fine. Your wife will never know.
Okay, sounds good. All right. We live close enough. Maybe that'll work. Well, thank you for being here, Oliver. Appreciate it. Well, while all our other co-hosts are actually gallivanting around the beautiful state of Alaska, Oliver and I are going to get to business here. And today we're going to discuss dark data. That's right. This is the data that you inadvertently collect and store that might be not so valuable to you. But I'll tell you one thing. Cyber criminals, they love it. It's gold to them. So we're going to talk about that. Plus, our guest today, Ranga Badla, he's Vice President of Field Engagement and Marketing at Oracle, and we're going to talk about simplifying your tech stacks, help you reduce some of your costs there. But we're also going to try to define a threshold for you, because obviously sometimes when you have lots of change, lots of new tech, you can sometimes get into tech debt as well. So we're going to talk about that. Lots coming up, so definitely stick around. But first, it's been a busy week in the enterprise, so we definitely should get into our news blips. In an alarming update this week via this TechCrunch article, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, or TSMC, the world's foremost contractor in chip making, has confirmed a cybersecurity breach. Now, the Lockbit ransomware gang with ties to Russia claims responsibility and threatens to release sensitive data unless a whopping $70 million ransom is actually met. Now, this incident raises the stakes in cyber warfare with such a hefty ransom demand, considering one of the highest on record. Equinix cyber threat intelligence researcher William Thomas states that the refusal to pay could lead to a further exposure of network entry points and credential data. The breach was traced back to an IT hardware supplier, KinMax Technology, and involves information crucial for server initial setup and configuration. Assuring its stakeholders, TSMC has emphasized that neither its business operations nor customer data has been compromised. However, they swiftly severed, actually, data exchange with KinMax, acting to in accordance with their security protocols. Now, question is it too late? Server exchanging, you know, severing their exchange data with them? Sorry, guys, I think the data is already compromised. Well, we'll see. KinMax, a well-regarded IT services, a consulting organization with high-profile partners such as HPE, Cisco, Microsoft, Citrix, and VMware, discovered the attack on its specific testing environment. Now, well, no further comments around the incidents have come up or any affected customers. This incident serves as a stark reminder of the global risk posed by ransomware attacks.
Okay, it's time to say goodbye to CentOS, apparently. So Red Hat, you know, those guys have been the name of the game for Enterprise Linux for probably more than 20 years now. But despite the fact that it's been an extremely popular OS, probably the more popular OS, at least according to my old alma mater InfoWorld, is CentOS. And they're figuring up to 20 times more popular. So for the most part, up until now, CentOS was pretending to be a RHEL clone. I'm sorry, Red Hat Enterprise Linux, RHEL clone. But Red Hat killed that myth back in 2020 when it unveiled CentOS Stream. So that ride is about to end. Red Hat just announced that CentOS 7 will be end of life in June of 2024. So just like Redmond with Windows, you got no more software and no more security patches. The company also said that CentOS Stream will now be the only repository for any public RHEL-related source code. So if you're an enterprise that's using CentOS 7, and I think that's probably most enterprises, your IT planning for the next year had better include what you're going to do once you're off CentOS. According to Red Hat, there's already a safe and pretty straightforward way to do a cloud migration from Cent to RHEL. But then it got a little ominous. It says if you're doing that from Cent to anything else, like, say, Alma Linux or Rocky Linux, it's, quote, more difficult, unquote. Then again, Red Hat would have to say that. So if you want to run a test or, you know, 10, that probably wouldn't be out of line if you like freebie Linux clones. But, you know, speaking from personal IT experience, I think there's better CYA in just going the Red Hat route than there is in striking out in some freebie version.
It wouldn't be an enterprise week without a leak. Now, this week, we need to discuss a financial cyber attack campaign targeting vulnerable SSH servers with the goal of turning them into nodes for a covert peer-to-peer proxy network like Peer-to-Profit or Honey Gain. Now, the threat dubbed as proxy jacking, uses SSH for remote access, running scripts to subtly include victim servers in the network. Now, unlike cryptojacking, which illicitly uses a system's resources for mining cryptocurrency, proxy jacking uses the victim's unused bandwidth to clandestinely actually run services in the background. Now, this offers dual benefits to the attackers. It enables monetization with a reduced resource load, making it more covert and thereby actually reducing chances of discovery. Now, the reverse actually exists because the anonymity provided by proxyware services can actually be misused by threat actors to obscure their attacks by routing traffic through intermediary nodes. Now, a more sinister twist in this tale is that threat actors have been found hosting a cryptocurrency miner on the same server, so indicating simultaneously cryptojacking and proxy jacking activities at the same time. Now, while proxyware isn't inherently malicious when installed without users' consent, it becomes a cybercrime tool, allowing the threat actor to actually control the system and generate illegal revenue. Now, to mitigate these risks, enterprises must, of course, adopt strong security practices like robust passwords or even MFA, rigorous patching engagement, which we talk about all the time, and of course, start logging some stuff.
So ChatGPT is still in diapers and it's already getting sued. So according to Information Week, ChatGPT got served not one but two papers while still in its crib, though it looks like they're well-deserved. So its parent company, OpenAI, is facing two lawsuits, which were both filed on Wednesday. The first suit sounds pretty nasty because it's stating that when OpenAI changed its policy in 2019 and went from being all hippy-dippy about good tech to being, hey, let's make some money, it decided to forget all about the principles that it said that originally it was going to observe, so little things like ethics and privacy and security. So the suite says that the company instead embarked on this massive grab of any personal data that it could get its grubby little mitts on, no matter where that data might be on the internet, or whom it might actually belong to. So that's private data, conversations, medical data, information about minors. Basically, if it was there and ChatGPT could get its hands on it, they took it. So as you might expect, the suit wants OpenAI to stop. And not just that, they want them to stop both commercial sales and use as well as any development on ChatGPT until new regs are put in place, somebody figures out what the right safeguards are, and that OpenAI not only implement those, but prove that it has implemented those. So we'll see how far that gets. The second lawsuit is kind of similar, but it's smaller in scope. It says that while it was being trained, OpenAI was using books to train ChatGPT, and it didn't ask whether it could use those books or not. It's a class action lawsuit, was filed in San Francisco, and it states that all the books that were taken and used by OpenAI were done without consent, without giving any kind of credit, and definitely not with any kind of compensation. I'm not sure how much traction the second suit is going to get because it's smaller in scope, but that first one is definitely going to make some waves. Considering that companies like IBM, Microsoft, big pile of others, they all want to use AI to make little AI of their own. And just like OpenAI, these big companies are moving ahead very fast, and they're hoping that the law catches up with them later. Meanwhile, all kinds of data is getting swiped, and not just from individuals using ChatGPT directly, but from anybody who's using a ChatGPT app integration, which means Spotify, Teams, Slack, and that's just a few. That list is long, and it's getting longer very, very fast. So this thing fries my clams because this concept of personal data and privacy on the internet is not like it's new. We've been talking about it for a long time. Regs are in place, and the fact that these guys are just ignoring it because they want to move along quickly with a new tech, that's just flat out wrong. Plus, if you've already had your data stolen, you're still going to be damaged even once any new regs get put in place because you can't put that genie back in the bottle. So Color Oliver upset.
Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the News Bites. But before we get to the News Bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Collide. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures unsecured devices that can't access your apps. Now, I work with enough organizations to know if you're allowing bring your own device or even securing the device set of managed devices that are out there, it's a difficult and almost next to impossible scale for an IT organization. Well, it's time to change that. Collide has some big news. If you're an Okta user, Collide can get your entire fleet to 100% compliance. Collide patches one of the major holes in zero trust architecture, and that's device compliance. Think about it. Your identity provider only lets known devices log into your apps, but just because a device is actually known doesn't mean it's a secure state. In fact, plenty of devices in your fleet probably shouldn't be trusted at all. Maybe they're running an out-of-date OS version, or maybe they got an unencrypted credentials lying around. Now, if a device isn't compliant or isn't running the Collide agent, it can't access the organization's SaaS apps or other resources. Now, the device user can't log into your company's cloud apps until they fix the problem on their end. It's really that simple. Now, for example, the device will be blocked if an employee doesn't have an up-to-date browser. Now, using end-user remediation actually helps drive your fleet to 100% compliance without overwhelming your IT team. Without Collide, IT teams have no way to solve these compliance issues or stop insecure devices from logging in. Now, with Collide, you can set and enforce compliance across your entire fleet, whether it be Mac, Windows, and even Linux. Now, Collide is unique in that it makes device compliance part of the authentication process. Now, when a user logs in with Okta, Collide alerts them to compliance issues and prevents unsecured devices from actually logging in. Now, it's security you can feel good about because Collide puts transparency and respect for users at the center of their product. To sum it up, Collide's method means fewer support tickets, less frustration, and most importantly, 100% fleet compliance. Visit collide.com/twiet to learn more or book a demo. That's KOLIDE.com/twiet. And we thank Collide for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's time for the Bites. Now, let's talk about a little known gold mine for cyber criminals. That's right. That's called dark data. This is information that companies actually forget about. It's that data you maybe mistakenly collect and store, which doesn't really factor in any business transactions, but it's really a great value to threat actors. Now, in the digital age where data forms really the backbone of many of the decisions that businesses make, it's unsurprised, and it's not really surprising, that an excess or dormant amount of data or dark data is actually piling up in the background. Now, imagine the cost of storing such data. Let's put it into perspective a little bit. Netflix last year, they shelled out around $10 million monthly for cloud storage in 2019. Now, dark data, comparable to dark matter in physics per the Gartner research, is more than just sensitive customers or employee data. It extends to system backups, those log files you're collecting, configuration files, even sensitive internal procedures. A lot more there as well. Alarmingly, many companies actually store this data beyond the mandatory retention period because there are some regulations that say you need to store it, like HIPAA or GDPR. So the question is, how do we protect from this unknown data? Well, there's some really good steps in this dark reading article, actually. There's a 5-step plan. Now, first, they suggest increase your data visibility, build a data inventory, and perform threat modeling to understand and quantify threats and prioritize those solutions. Second, you should think about your adversary. You know, use ethical hacking and really use professional security testers to actually uncover some of your vulnerabilities. And once you have a clear picture of your data footprint, counter that. I thought as well, reinforce security controls and target areas, enforce policies. Also make sure you delete unnecessary sensitive data, a strategy we like to call shrinking the battle space. Now, avoid relying solely on data loss prevention tools. Don't rely only on them. Remember, it's a balance between people, process, and technology. Now back your chosen tools with really well-documented processes and workflows. I can tell you that if you don't do that, obviously, the next person is not going to know. Plus, that, of course, managed by skilled professionals. Now, dark data, while seemingly irrelevant, can actually be costly if it's not managed correctly. Remember, it may also be elusive asset, but it's also potentially your most expensive liability. So think about that. So I want to bring Oliver in. Oliver, this is an important topic because a lot of organizations obviously collect data. Sometimes they don't even know that they're collecting this data. What do you think, how do you think is important for people, especially organizations, to know about this? Like what should they be doing other than the stuff that the article says?
Well, the stuff the article says isn't exactly easy. I mean, right. When you go out and you look at what people term dark data, I mean, it's anything. It's that email thread that you did, or that the fired guy that you canned last week did because you didn't delete his email store. It's the TIFF snapshot that somebody took of the whiteboard and then put on their hard disk or put up on the cloud share and then forgot about. It's that, you know, that PowerPoint presentation that you started and didn't finish. It's all that stuff. So you've got to find it. That's, you know, plus speaking of Netflix, by the way, this is not new. I mean, it's got a cute name now, but I think Netflix is showing that movie Hackers. Remember that from 1995 with little kids running around in the really bad visual representation of an enterprise data center? That's what those kids were hunting then, right? Snippets of documents and a document that somebody forgot about that they can use. This is old stuff. And right. I think if you have to identify the worst problem, to me, it's finding it, which I don't think is going to be that hard now that you have AI. I think finding it's going to be fairly straightforward. But after that, managing it, securing it, to me, that all sounds like you're going to have user hurdles. And as soon as you know, that's going to be a howling horde of users. And I think that's probably what's going to keep most businesses from doing this.
I think the next challenging part is that you really can't just go blindly delete it. I mean, yeah. Obviously, organizations say, oh, you have this bunch of stuff. We have a bunch of emails or we have a bunch of like log data or whatever. You just can't go blindly delete it. One, because you could be violating policies and compliance. And two, because you could be getting rid of data that people may or may not need later on. So I think this is one of the other challenging things, I think, with dark data is you need a way to essentially classify this data and catalog it in some way and then maybe even quantify its value. So I think that's another hard part here. Now, The article emphasizes the balance of people, process, and technology in data protection. What do you think? What's your point of view here? Is that really the main challenge of organizations for data protection, is the fact that they have to balance that?
Yes, without, I mean, look, the tool, this is, I mean, you've asked me these questions or similar questions several times, and I'm always the old time snarky guy who says, the tools that we need to use, we already have, we just have to use them. It's true. That is exact. And it's the same thing here with the, maybe AI is a new point, but as far as securing and classifying and user access, that's all there, right? Putting it in place, that's a hurdle. And then convincing your users that, you know, the extra hoops that they're going to have to jump through are worth it and keep them safer and making them care about that. Right. To me, that's always going to be the biggest hurdle.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really interesting. A lot of organizations that are large, especially large enterprises, they don't know that they have this data there. And so, or they do, and they just are storing it for no good reason. In fact, I've actually seen organizations where they've gone through what they call COGS week, where they actually go in and, they task their teams. I actually was a witness of this in one organization I visited, where they actually task their teams to reduce COGS by trying to find ways to reduce data retention, data storage. I think that's pretty interesting because, that means that, again, they just don't have visibility into this data. I think it's a problem whether you're a huge conglomerate or a small, SMB. It's definitely a problem. Now, I talked a little bit about my blip about TSMC. They're sharing their data that got compromised. I think that just by them saying they severed their data connections here, it doesn't really mean anything, because it could mean that their dark data here, the dark data that they thought wasn't really valuable, could actually be super valuable to cyber criminals, because they can weed through it, they can utilize it, they can use it for other purposes. Now, do you think that this is a dark horse for a lot of organizations, especially from a cyber criminal perspective?
Yeah, because it really depends upon how you define dark data, right? I think the article you're looking at had a pretty, I think the word I'm looking for is optimistic definition, right, of dark data, right? I read some other articles about it, and man, they're IDing it as not just stuff in your on your official cloud servers, but your hard disk. Your thumb drives, there's always some weenie out there who thinks that his personal Google Drive is the same thing as his hard drive. So he dumps stuff there and he has a 1234 password. All that stuff can be dark data. So finding it, classifying that, and then, putting DRM or TTL restrictions on stuff that's spread out that far. I mean, that's a major project. I'm not saying that you shouldn't try it, and I think you definitely need to. I'm just saying it's not gonna be a short term play.
Right. Yeah, I think there are some easy aspects. I don't mean easy, maybe simple, I guess you could say. Like, for instance, you could institute data retention policies, right? Where you can say, hey, data that's stored here or here will only be around for so long unless you need it. And of course, users will be alerted when it's time to go. There's also data storage places, like things like SharePoint or OneDrive or whatever the cloud storage that you use out there. They have ways to essentially have similar data retention policies where you can enact things around, hey, this data can only be here for so long, this file is too large, that kind of thing. But like you said, there's other places, like, for instance, log files. I think this is a pretty interesting one. A lot of teams that I've interacted with in some organizations, whether it's financial industry or whatnot, they have only a small amount of retention for especially log files, only because, again, there's a level of compliance that needs to be applied there, as well as it's also a costly thing to store log files. Do you really need 60, 90 days worth of logs if you've already processed them and computed data off of them? So that's also another interesting topic. Take a look at the fact that, do you really need all of those logs from whether it's your hardware, your services, your applications, because they might not be useful after a certain amount of time. They have a level of expiration, I guess, on the usefulness. So I think another thing that I want to talk about here just a little bit is the fact that there's obviously practical steps and innovative tools here. Do you know, Oliver, of any like tools that can help with something like this, to help go out and catalog what people are using for data storage and data sources and help them kind of find a way to manage it a little bit better? Or is there just a kind of a conglomerate of older tools?
Well, that actually brings me to a question that I wanted to ask you, but
yeah,
I'll answer yours first. Yeah. No, I don't think there's any new tools other than AI. I think somebody is going to turn who wants to make a quick $1 billion is going to turn, you know, a good AI algorithm toward this specific task. I mean, this would be exactly what that tech is would be good at. But for you, I'd like to ask, I think the last time I worked with the SQL guys was back 2012, 2014. It was SQL Azure. And back then they were having me do stuff on data lakes. You know, don't worry about structured data. Just toss it all into this big bucket. And we have really smart algorithms that'll organize it and do your queries for you. Do you think this trend or this discovery of this trend is going to push people back toward structured data?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think so. I think that the fact is you're going to get unstructured from lots of different sources, obviously. I mean, there's going to be hardware, there's going to be software, there's going to be services, there's going to be dependencies that will still shell out unstructured data. So you're going to need a way to store it no matter what. Now, would that mean that we could process that data and create some structure out of it, create some entities and actually kind of extract structured data from it and then just store the structured data? That could be. I think that could be maybe a push to getting away from the data lake scenarios. However, I don't think data lakes will go away. And obviously I don't think that unstructured data will go away. And people already have processes to utilize it. So I think that, you know, just making it so that they can have better data management and retention in places like data lakes is probably the best course of action rather than trying to rid yourself of the data lake scenario. But I don't think they'll go away anytime soon.
Okay.
It's cool. I think that this is one of those things that it's interesting because, you know, we talk a lot with, and I talk a lot with organizations who don't really consider dark data as a really important thing. However, especially in the health industry, this is a very interesting thing because they do sometimes collect a ton of extra data. And although they don't know if they need it or not, they have to comply with things like HIPAA when it comes to it. And so now they have to retain that data for a certain period of time, even though they might think it's not valuable. So do you think that there's maybe other parts of it? And I don't know of any other parts of industry that, you know, that might collect as much data as maybe the health industry does, maybe unnecessary data. But do you know of any other, you know, industries that do that, that might have a similar problem, especially around being compliant?
Well, I mean, the example I would use in the medical industry would have been the one, I don't know if you've been to the doctor recently, but the last time I went, the guy's wheeling around on a cart, his little computer setup. But the last time I went, he's taking notes with a pen, an electric pen on a screen.
Right.
So that type of dark data, you know, he didn't put that in a database. That's just sitting there. And so if you're thinking about that in other industries, I mean, yeah, personal finance. I'm sure there's a lot of, you know, unofficial notes being taken, unofficial strategies with names. I hope not account numbers. That would scare the hell out of me, but I'm sure that's there off the top of my head. What else? Anything with estate planning and lawyers. I mean,
yes.
My wife, like you should see all the, I mean, she's like me, old school. So she has a bunch of paper notebooks, but I've done work at a bunch of legal offices and she would be the exception these days, not the rule. So there is going to be tons of dark data generated by lawyers taking notes, by lawyers mapping out strategies, by their whiteboard. I mean, it'll just go on. So yeah. And all those, I think both finance and the legal industry are subject to GDPR and various regulations here. So, you know, right. it's going to be another lawyer fest, which means it's not going to get, regulations very quickly, but right. Hopefully we'll get them.
Yep. Yeah. I definitely think that one good, recommendation is definitely check out backups too, because I'd say one of the biggest things, obviously with most organizations, they have a lot of backups and I don't think that they realize that they're not only backing up, you know, useful data, but they're also backing up dark data. And I think this is not only a risk for them from a security perspective, but it's also a risk from, from a financial perspective. I think it's, you know, it's an expensive thing to be backing things up like that. And you're going to need to go in and review all that. So I definitely think this is a tough challenge. And I think this is a challenge that organizations will continue to fight over time. I do think you're right, though. I do think that if somebody has some big idea out there, they can come in and actually review all of your data, just like they do with a lot of the networking hardware that's out there today. They kind of review all your logs coming in, transactions, just like Splunk or whatnot. If they can do that with all of your data and actually give you some idea on how to go in and make use of it, secure it, delete it, put policies on it, I think that there could be a completely new product there. I definitely think it'd be a very lucrative product for sure.
I'll send you a business plan.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Oliver. Okay. Well, that does it for that. Let's move on to the guests because we have a great guest today. Drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Lookout. Business has basically changed forever. Boundaries to where we work or even how we work have literally disappeared. And that means your data is always on the move, whether it's on a device or it's in the cloud or across networks or at the local coffee shop. Well, that's great for your workforce. It's really a challenge for IT security. And Lookout helps you control your data and free your workforce. Now, with Lookout, you gain complete visibility into all your data so you can minimize risk for internal threats, plus ensure compliance by seamlessly securing hybrid work, or your organization doesn't have to sacrifice productivity for security. Now, and Lookout makes IT security a lot simpler. Now, working with multi-point solutions and legacy tools, today's environment is really complex. It's too complex. With its single unified platform, Lookout reduces IT complexity, giving you more time to focus on whatever comes your way. Now, good data protection isn't a cage. It's a springboard, letting you and your organization bound toward a future of your making. Visit lookout.com today to learn how to safeguard data, secure hybrid work, and reduce IT complexity. That's lookout.com. And we thank Lookout for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually could get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Today we have Ranga Bolda. He's Vice President of Field Engagement and Marketing of Oracle. Welcome to the show, Ranga.
Hey, Lou. Hey, Oliver. How are you guys doing this afternoon?
Doing well. Thanks for being here. Now, I forgot to tell you before the show, but hopefully this is not a surprise. Our first question normally is the fact that our organization is such a diverse audience. We have so many people that are starting out in their career, and they, you know, maybe even CTOs, CIOs, and CEOs. In fact, I do know that we have a bunch of those listening to the show. They love to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us through a short journey through tech and what brought you to Oracle?
Happy to. So I've been in the industry for 25 years. I know I only look 25, but I've actually been in the industry for 25 years. Started my career at IBM, was at some startups out in Silicon Valley, some spectacular failures, and found my way to a startup that got acquired by SAP. And then joined NetSuite, which is the organization I'm in now, and was there for about 6 years before we got acquired by Oracle. So I've been in this journey now for about 13 years, about 6.5 years prior to acquisition, and then another six and a half years here post acquisition. So it's been a fun time, and you know, during that time frame, I've gone from everything from product management to sales to marketing, and gotten to experience a lot of those different things. But you know, when I started at IBM, it was funny. We were working on outsourced cloud, outsourced analytics via the cloud, and no one even understood what the heck that was back in 1997, 1998. They just didn't even understand that concept. So it's funny now because it's just kind of a given, whereas back then it was definitely pushing a string uphill. I could say that for sure.
Right. Well, I can say 20 years ago, I started my career in ERP. So I can definitely tell you it's great to see integrations and automations happening in that part of the industry. But before we get into that, I want to start with tech stacks. Now, many businesses today, they grapple with the problem of bloated tech stacks, complexity, lots of things like that. You know, how would you recommend these companies simplify their technology infrastructure without really sacrificing both functionality and efficiency?
You know, it's the thing that I see happen, and this is regardless of size of company. I see this happen in small organizations. I say small, like even like two or three or four people type organizations to very, very large organizations. This notion of tech bloat or having too many solutions, it happens all the time. You end up with this hairball of solutions. And part of it is it's just you find a problem, you find a solution for it, and then you find another problem and you find another solution for it. And you sometimes don't take a step back to say, well, maybe we should be thinking about this a little bit more strategically. And I think that you are seeing that shift a little bit. I think we even see it from a consumer perspective. You and I personally, from a consumer perspective, you know, you look at your subscriptions. I mean, how many subscriptions do you have nowadays? And then you kind of, it's like every periodically you go through and you say, oh, wait, you know what? Do I really need 17 prescriptions to watch TV? Maybe not. Maybe I only need to go back to two, maybe or three or four, whatever it is. The same thing's happening on the tech side where I think people are looking back and saying, well, you know what? I went and bought all these different subscriptions, all these different software, different things to go and solve these solutions. Can we take a step back as we're thinking about the more long-term approach as we're going to grow? And frankly, we've also got to save some dollars because, you know, it's not growth at all costs, but how do we be much more intelligent in how we grow and how we go after these things? And so I think, you know, it seems simple, but I think there is a little bit of taking a step back, that collaboration between the CFO and the CIO. You're seeing finance professionals get much more aligned with the IT professionals in the organization. It's much less of a adversarial relationship and much more of a, hey, how can we help each other to enable the company to be a better organization, to be in a better spot? And I think those are some of those ways I think that become part of that, Lou.
You bring up a good point. I do want to dig into that for just a second, because I think I do like the fact that you're right. A lot of organizations do pay for a lot of things they don't need. They pay for even some of the baseline things that they're going out there, whether it's cloud services or services in the cloud or, you know, anything, whether it's storage or whatnot. They're usually paying their baseline foundational part of their subscriptions, give them a bunch of stuff they don't need, when the fact they probably should go find another service provider, another provider that maybe doesn't require that and is maybe less expensive that can do the same thing. So I think there's that opportunity, especially in this day and age. Now, you shared a little bit about your thoughts around the CIO and the CFO working together. Now, I think that's great, but how do you maybe foster such a relationship to make sure that it's, you know, a well aligned? Because obviously the CFO is worried about revenue and the fact that, you know, there's obviously the cost of operations and there's also the intern coming in revenue. The CIO is only really worried about, how they're doing with the information and what they're doing with their services and that kind of thing. And so how do you kind of foster that alignment?
Well, I think both, I mean, some of it has come naturally. I think there is a little bit of the market conditions. I mean, just the nature of how some of the stuff has shifted. There is a little bit more of where folks do want to work more closely together because, you know, frankly, the CIO is interested in trying out, bringing in new technology into the organization, bringing in new ideas, bringing in new ways to be smarter and more efficient. The CFO is looking at how can I get the organization to be more cost effective? How can I drive more revenue? How can I drive more margin to the bottom line? And so they're both aligned from that perspective is, hey, if I can eliminate some of this stuff that's we're not really using and isn't really helping us, then it frees up capital or frees up dollars for me to go in and pull in things that actually help on that front. You made a really good comment there about, you know, a lot of people who have a lot of stuff that's sitting on the shelf. I mean, the original premise of the cloud was that, all these cloud services, you know, people weren't going to have a bunch of shelfware. You and I both know that's not the reality of what's happened. In fact, people go and buy it. And it may be that they're using maybe some baseline of it, but they're not, you know, they have 100 seats and they're using 10, or they have, 1,000 seats and they're using 100. But either way, there's an opportunity to both reduce and make sure that you're actually using it, And I'm not saying that people have to just eliminate those services. It may be also just an issue of, hey, maybe I've got these services in the same place, and now I can go and go and leverage them. And ultimately, if I can free both the CIO and the CFO are looking at how can I free up dollars to either A, drive more margin, or to drive more innovation. And they're both kind of aligned in that. It's not to say that you one-to-one, I cut this much spending, it's all going to go to the bottom line. There's going to be somewhere in the middle, but they've got to be chatting about that to figure that out as an organization.
Right. Now, obviously, when you cut things, obviously, maybe sometimes you need to replace things as well. So you might think, oh, I need to maybe reduce my cost because I'm using this service or this application or this system, but I need a replacement that maybe comes with less bells and whistles, but might be less expensive. However, sometimes it's a challenge to evaluate new technologies. How does that work when you're collaborating with the CIO and the CFO together and they're working together? How are they evaluating these new things?
I mean, I think this sometimes people don't actually go through that process of, like, you know, literally it's like the conversation I have with my kids sometimes about, like, you know, you got to make that checklist of the pros and cons. And, you know, it's like, what are really the things I actually need versus the things I'd like to have? And I think that exercise is a really big part of that conversation, which is not just using. It still happens, to be clear, but I think you're starting to see less and less of it where it's like, I'm going to just go and download the big feature list. And it's like, okay, every solution I look at, it's got to have these 2,700 features. And if you don't, you know, if you only have 2,200 features, you know what, I'm going to eliminate you off the short list. I think it's really coming back to that, like, what's actually going to help me run my business better. What's going to actually, you know, so I've been in NetSuite for 13 years, like I mentioned, and, you know, we're always putting out new releases. We're always putting out new features, but, you know, the thing I find and look, there are some solutions out there. There's some on-premise solutions, for example, that were purpose-built for a given industry. And if I was to compare that solution to our solution for that exact industry, you might look at it and say, oh, well, they got 1,000 features and we have 780. I'm making these numbers up, obviously. But my point in saying that is, you know, the reality, though, is they may get more features, but if they don't have the flexibility to go and integrate with some of those other systems, to go and get access to their data, to make smarter choices. I mean, you guys were just talking about thinking about your data and how you're smart about your data and who has access to it and privacy. I mean, these are the other things that people need to be thinking about too when you think about your tech stack, is how many people am I giving my data up to that my data or not giving up my data, but, you know, that has access to my information and where it's stored and where that information is.
Right. Well, when we come back, I do want to talk more, and I want to get into the ERP segment here and talk about that data integration, because that's actually a very important thing for organizations to understand. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's ZipRecruiter. Now, if you're looking to hire people, you know, the market right now, it's flooded with a lot of potential candidates, and it's a buyer's market out there, and you need a way to weed through the forest to find the right candidate. Plus, you're currently dealing with economic uncertainty, which adds to the challenge. Now more than ever, it's more important to hire the right people faster and more efficiently to keep overall costs down. Thankfully, there's a hiring partner who's focused on you and your needs. That's ZipRecruiter. Now, from pricing to technology, everything that ZipRecruiter does is for you and what works best for you. And right now you can try them free at ZipRecruiter.com/Twyatt. Go there right now. I'll wait. Now, let me tell you a little bit about how ZipRecruiter prioritizes your needs. They have straightforward pricing. That's right. You know what you pay for before you post your job, so you can stick to your budget, no surprises. Reach more qualified people. That's right. ZipRecruiter sends your job post to more than 100 job sites. Find great candidates faster with their smart technology and invite the best matches to actually apply for your job. Beat out the competition for talent, because ZipRecruiter lets you invite candidates you really want to apply to your job before other businesses can actually snag them. Now, if you invest in a partner that you need to expand your business, ZipRecruiter needs to be that partner. Hire the best with the help of a partner who's all about you, ZipRecruiter. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/TWIET. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TWIET. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we'll be talking with Rangan Boldla. He's VP at Oracle, but I do want to bring my co-host back in as well because, you know, Oliver has been around the industry for a long time. Curtis is gallivanting in Alaska. I don't know why he's on my mind. But I want to hear some things from him. So, Oliver, any questions?
Sure. Yeah. So we actually did an ERP roundup back in, I think, for PC Mag back in 2016, 2015, which I think is when you and I might have met. And that was the biggest bear nightmare of a roundup test that I have done since we had to do object-oriented databases back in the mid-90s. And the two things people complained about the most, users, I mean, and wanted us to look at, which was practically impossible, was A, lead time, right? The biggest hurdle people saw was, wow, these things are so huge, they can be so efficient, but then when they really tried to implement it, they got frightened or overwhelmed. And then the last one was the other one was customization. That was like a no issue before 2015, but it was starting to change in 2015, 2016. You're able to build your own dashboards, things like that. So how is NetSuite talking to customers about that, about both those things now?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, let me take each one separately. On the lead time or the implementation side, we really were very focused now, and especially now compared to those almost 6 years ago now, 7 years almost, is this notion of bite small, chew faster. I think all the vendors out there are guilty of, you know, it's like, oh, you got to go and consume as much as you can on day one. And, you know, that's the reality is that doesn't work. You really got to think about this notion of take a small chunk, get successful with it, and then add on to that. And the more you do that, the better off you'll be. And I think, you know, I think it is a little bit of a change. It's something that we espouse, particularly on the notion of this cloud side of things, is look, you become a customer. It's the beginning of your journey. It's not, you know, it's not like on premise where you sell this big deal, get it implemented, and you walk away. In our world, it's very much about like we want to get you as a customer, get you successful, and then continue to grow with you. And you know, in our world, as we look at it, is if you're successful, you're continuing to iterate, you're continuing to add on, you're looking across your landscape, and you're saying, you know what? I do this manually today. I'm going to go in and figure somebody out and figure out how I can build that in the system. We actually had a customer, and I love this story. The guy, he had two college hires, these computer science guys, and he said, here's what your job is. I want you to walk around our business and I want you to talk to people about what they do manually. And if you can figure out how to build that into the system, I'll give you a timeline I'll give you a bonus. And they did this for like 2 years and they had all these great changes they made, all these great efficiencies. And then they ended up quitting, and went and built their own business, their own NetSuite business, to literally, help do this with other clients. And it was like they learned all this great stuff on how to do these customizations. And then they went and did it for other clients. And, that comes to your second question on the customization front. We always recommend to folks, look, every client is going to have certain business processes that are really unique to them, that are differentiated, and they got to make sure follow. The reality though is a lot of processes, a lot of things, order to cash, procure to pay, a lot of the base processes that are out there, they're not necessarily that different. They're not even necessarily that different by industry. I mean, I'm saying there's some nuances. And so we really focus on, hey, here's what the standard process looks like. Can you show me what your process looks like and where you really see that a differentiated process is a competitive advantage for you? And if it is, look, we'll work with you to make sure that you have that and you can customize it. And you know what? That customization will go with our upgrades and everything. But we really try to take it forward with them to make sure that the customizations make sense and that they can continue it forward. again, I don't necessarily think customization is a bad word. But what I think is important is making sure that you've got the right set of customizations that you actually need, as opposed to just taking, you know, what happens sometimes is people are on one system, they move to a new one, and they're like, you know what, we're going to replicate that existing system, you know, from scratch, rather than thinking about is there a benefit. I mean, we now, you know, we're I think in our latest release, you know, up to 37,000 customers. You know, we really think about how do we take what we learn from our customers and feed that back to our clients, because you know what. What we see, you know, by continually implementing those different clients, we're seeing what works, what doesn't work. We're seeing how we can optimize those processes, and we want to bring that across. So, when we say, you know, you can absolutely customize, but you may not want to, it's not because the system doesn't allow it. It's more about a conversation of you are protecting your business processes so that they're not, you know, overly complex. And, it's also important that those customizations be able to move forward, and that's another piece of this as well.
You actually bring up a good point around customization. I think I want to ask a question about that, because I think with ERP especially, the fact is a lot of ERP systems today, in order to get the data integrations that people need, you need to customize the system. Now, and obviously sometimes you're customizing the system to so much that it's hard for you, basically locked in to that system. There's no way you can move off that system, move to something else less expensive, because you're locked in with customers. And that exists not in just ERP, but pretty much anywhere if you think about it. What's some of your suggestions around that? Like, obviously, is it more looking for systems that have deep integrations by default?
No, I don't necessarily think you have to look at deep integrations by default. One of the approaches that we take, we have two new releases every year. We had we do one in the spring, we do one in the fall. And one of the things we really push is that all of our customizations move forward. So, you know, it's like when you go to the newest release, those move forward. And every single one of our clients, when I say we have 37,000 clients, every single one of those 37,000 clients is on the exact same version of NetSuite. Now there's like some small like window when everyone's getting upgraded there's an upgrade window. But once that process is done, everybody's on again on the same release. What that means though for our partners is if somebody says, hey, we're integrated with NetSuite, Shopify is a partner that's integrated with NetSuite. When they say that, it's not like, well, I'm integrated with version 2010.2. It's they're integrated with NetSuite. It's not that they're integrated with, you know, 2015. And so there's this notion of version lock that I think is really important, that, you know, what's the partner ecosystem look like, and making sure that when you are looking at add-ons, when you're looking at integrations, when you're looking at those, that those things that you're getting don't lock you in to a specific release. And I think that's unfortunately what really have happened with a lot of the on-premise ERP systems, and even some of the cloud ones, is people got locked into a version of the system and they couldn't upgrade, they couldn't change. And then even if they wanted to leverage all these great new technologies out there, they couldn't. And, you know, then you have the issue of trying to find resources that can use that. And, you know, consulting firms make a lot of money off of that.
Right. So I think one thing that I find interesting about NetSuite is the fact that it's built on Oracle's Fusion Cloud. And I think the interesting thing about that is it can run on Oracle's cloud, but it can also be lifted, shifted, and run on other infrastructure. Is this kind of a very similar, going back to like obviously spend and reducing costs? Some people might say, hey, listen, I'm paying for more than what I need. I might want to move this off and move it somewhere else less expensive. How easy is it for an organization to do that?
So it's not that you're gonna move this off of. So we're hosted. We leverage OCI, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, to that's the data center that we leverage, and you know we're focused on the application. It really sits within that. I don't know that someone's gonna necessarily move. We don't go off of and work in other clouds. Now we can integrate with other clouds. So sometimes where somebody has, they might have another application in another cloud, or they might have an on-premise system and they can integrate with that. And it's all, you know, depending if they want to then bring that into OCI as well, They have that option. But, you know, it's also something that Oracle in general has been really focused on is we either want, you know, people can leverage our cloud. They can work with other clouds. I mean, in fact, Microsoft and you know, Oracle have had a lot of partnerships around this. You know, I think it's important to note that, you know, we're not so, arrogant to believe that, you know, we're the only cloud out there. We know that there's these other clouds and in some cases, we got to make sure that we're able to integrate with that. And that's something that's probably the important thing there.
I did have one more. So actually maybe two, two-tier ERP. I'm still hearing people talk about two-tier ERP in this day and age. Like, is that still a thing for NetSuite? And if so, like, how do you talk to customers about that?
You know, it is still a thing. And it's what it is they've got a system. It's not broke. Let's not, you know, they've got a system there and they don't want to just take a huge set of invested, IP and hours and just take that and go through a brand new ERP implementation. What they want to do though, is they've got a new business venture. They've got a new country. They've got, a new part of their business that they're trying to go after. And in those cases, they need to make sure that they have a, you know, an ERP system to run that. And oftentimes it's not just cheaper, but also faster to leverage NetSuite and integrate in a two-tier fashion than go and say, expand the existing system. That, you know, that they already invested in and, you know, for that new venture. That's oftentimes where we see that really that two-tier environment is, it's expansion. It's expansion in some way, shape or form, whether it's international or, business model based.
Right. And then I got a soft one. So sure. This is based on personal experience. So if you were on one side of the table now and Lou and I were on the other, I'd be the guy chasing down the workflows, you know, dark data, the dark workflows. I had to use that, the dark workflows. And Lou would be the data integration guy. But I've actually been in a room where I'm the data integration guy and they sent in some Yahoo who was, you know, calls himself the CIO. And he has decided he doesn't need to do any workflow chasing. He knows it all. And you see him heading for a buzzsaw, like you just know it. And there's not a lot you can say. How, I mean, can you guys mandate a fix there? Like, how do your sales guys or your field engineers handle that issue? Like, when they see a guy, you just know it's going to crash. Like, what do you do?
You know, it. I still always think it comes back to we have this really big notion of, sell what you deliver, deliver what you sell, and we want to be really transparent up front. We had a problem a few years back. It's more than a few years back now, but you know, we had this issue sometimes where we would demo something and it wasn't purposeful. It wasn't like or malicious, I should say. And we had our demo environment and the demo environment didn't match what necessarily they saw on day one when they were implementing. And so we changed that. That was really what we tried to do with Suite Success. And it was this notion of sell what you deliver, deliver what you sell, so that when you, As a user, when you go or a buyer, when you see the demo, what you see and what the version, like the dashboards and all the things that you're seeing, all those bells and whistles, when you go and implement, that's what you get on day one. Because what we want to make sure of is that we're not misleading you to think, you know, where you have that. And so, you know, when you get somebody that's like, hey, I know exactly what they're, well, we want to show them exactly what you get. And if he or she is like, I don't want any of that, we'll cut that out. We'll cut that out. And they know that what they're getting is what they asked for. But we want to try to be as straightforward as possible in that regard. We actually call it the alignment call, where we're going through and we're aligning like, hey, here's what the business process is for order to cash. Here's what the business process is for procure to pay. Here's the hire to fire. Like, we go through those business processes that they want to see and make sure that they see that ahead of time so that there's not misset expectations and that they know what they're getting themselves into.
Cool. Ronger, with any great show, time flies. Unfortunately, we're running low on time. I just want to give you a chance to maybe tell the folks at home a little bit about Oracle NetSuite, where they can find more, maybe where they can get started, understand some of the integrations.
Sure, I'm happy to. So, you know, netsuite.com, of course, that's always the best place to get more information about NetSuite. Probably the biggest thing, you know, as we've talked about here, is 37,000 companies around the world run NetSuite to manage their business. That's everything from supply chain to finance to CRM. You know, these are all elements of the business. We were actually, this is the 25-year anniversary of NetSuite. You know, we're one of the few founder-led companies out there. Evan Goldberg, who founded NetSuite 25 years ago, he still runs NetSuite, you know, reporting directly into Safra Katz, our CEO. And the great thing is he's passionate about making sure that every company has access to the types of technology that we can offer. And so rather than targeting the Fortune 500, it's about targeting the Fortune 5 million and making sure and provide them the power of what we have to offer.
Thanks again for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise and IT podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host today, Oliver. Thank you so much for being here. It's always a pleasure seeing you. Can you tell the folks at home what's coming up for you and maybe where people can find you and your work?
You mentioned it earlier. Worth Magazine is my new home, and I'm just kicking off the gear issue. They're actually going to let me write the most innovative gear issue, but the boss already took golf. So that leaves me hunting down, what do super rich people do for fun that has gear in it? Best I can come up is maybe yacht gear, or I don't know. I got to think about it. If you have any suggestions, feel free to send them over. But that's my next project.
Thanks, Eller. Thanks. Appreciate you being here. Well, folks, I want to thank you as well. That's right. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. And I want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to catch up on your enterprise news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes. Of course, all of our notes for the show, of course, are there as well. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Get your audio version or your video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices, because we're on all of them, all of your podcast applications. Definitely subscribe, support the show, and be part of the movement. But of course, if you haven't subscribed, you could also be part of Club Twit as well. That's right. It's a members only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else. And it's only $7 a month. And there's a ton of great things about Club Twit, especially the fact that you don't have any ads as part of our shows. But most importantly, also, there's also the exclusive access to our members only Discord server. There you can chat with hosts and producers. I'm in it right now. You can have lots of separate side discussions and channels. There's a ton of channels in there. There's a cooking channel. I mean, lots of great channels in there. Lots of great discussions going on right now. Plus, they also have special events, which I witnessed this week, which was awesome. So thank you for all of that. So if you want to be part of that fun, be part of that movement, definitely join Club Twit at twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, just so you know, they also offer corporate group plans as well. It's a great way to give your team access to our ad-free tech podcast. The plans start at 5 members at a discounted rate of $6 each per month. And you can add as many seats as you like. And this is a great way for your IT departments, your developers, your support teams, your sales teams, whatever, to really stay up to date with all of our podcasts. And just like the regular memberships, you can jump into the Twit Discord server. You can be part of that Twit Plus bonus feed as well. So definitely check that out. Now, also, if you want to, you can also give this to your family as well. Family plans. That's right. Family plans are $12 a month. You get 2 seats in there. And then you can just add $6 each for each additional seat that you want to add. So a lot of great advantages to the single plan as well. You can also get the single plan. But just like everything else, you get the same advantages with the family plan as well. So lots of options. twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, after you subscribe, I want you to impress your family, your friends, your coworkers with the gift of Twyatt, because we have fun on this show. We have talked a lot about some fun tech topics. I guarantee they will find it fun and interesting as well. So have them subscribe. And if you've already subscribed, you should know that we do this show live. That's right. 1:30 p.m. Pacific time on Fridays. We're live right now. You can just go to live.twit.tv. That's the website. You'll see all the streams there. You can come see how the pizza's made, all the behind the scenes, all the banter before and after the show. So definitely jump into the live stream. And if you're watching the live stream, you got to jump into our infamous IRC channel as well, Twit Live channel. You just have to go to irc.twit.tv. And there are some great people in there, great characters each and every week. We have lots of fun discussions. In fact, they're giving me some really good show titles this week. Thank you guys for being there and being part of that. Lots of fun. So definitely check that out, irc.twit.tv. Now get a hold of me. I want you to hit me up on Twitter, LouMM. I'm LouMM on Twitter. Hit me up with a direct message. Just come and chat. You can see all the things that I post on there. You can also send me a message on LinkedIn. I always try to respond to all of them. I do that on Sunday evening. So if I don't get back to you right away, I apologize. Of course, I also am on Mastodon as well, as LouMM at twit.social. I'm going to check me out on there. I'm trying to get more used to doing that and posting on there as well. So definitely hit me up on there as well. Now, if you want to know what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft, you can check out developers.microsoft.com/office. There we do and post all the latest and greatest ways for you to customize your Office suite. There it is. And of course, if you got Microsoft 365, if you open Excel right now, there's a great new Automate tab. That Automate tab is a way for you to record things that you do in Excel, and you can play them back. You can edit the scripts directly. And this is JavaScript, TypeScript. It's all the new stuff, and you can run it on the web. You can even use it as an Excel script or run an Excel script in Power Automate. So a lot of fun stuff. You can do it unattended. So definitely check that out and be part of that as well. Now, I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and to Lisa. They continue to make this show possible and support the show each and every week and for many, many years. So thank you for their support. Of course, before we sign out, I want to thank our engineers and staff at Twit. I want to also thank Mr. Brian Chi, who's gallivanting around Alaska. I want to thank him as well. He's our producer, Tyler's producer, not co-host, but our producer as well. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show. And he also checked up on us before the show, even though he's probably on a cruise somewhere. So thank you, Chiebert, for doing that. Of course, before we sign out, I want to thank our editor for today because they make us look good after the fact. And of course, our TD, talented Mr. Ant Pruitt. Ant, it's always great to see you, my friend. What's going on for you this week in Twit?
Thanks, Mr. Lou. Just hanging out here, trying to keep my stuff rolling here inside of this TD booth. And hey, folks, Club Twit members, I had the opportunity to interview Mr. Hugh Howey. And if you don't know who that is,
great.
Think yeah. about Silo, the TV series. I'm still a bit beside myself about that opportunity. So, yeah, check that out.
Absolutely, absolutely. Definitely check that out. It was great. It was great. Thanks, Sam. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, a bunch of game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. But you already knew all that. What you may not know is that Twit now has a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.